This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, December 22nd, 2013. We are up to Chapter 3 of Rambam's Hilchot Shabbat. So far, we think we've kept a fairly decent pace about doing a half chapter a week, but you know that can be slower or quicker depending on how the discussion goes. As a quick summary, up until now, Rambam, is the way he normally works in Mishnah Torah, starts at the very general and then gradually gets more specific. So we began with the general laws about biblical versus rabbinic. Chapter 2 dealt with a lot of exceptions to Jewish law, again, more of the general theory. Now we're slowly starting to focus a little bit more on details. And specifically, Chapter 3 deals with stuff on Friday as preparation for Shabbat. This is kind of where the Shulchan Aruch begins, which is one reason why he didn't want to start there, because it can get very confusing if you just start with the Shulchan Aruch very quickly. Because the Shulchan Aruch writes in a more chronological fashion. But here's all the things you do to prep for Shabbat without actually going into, well, here's a biblical prohibition, here's a rabbinic prohibition. So, we'll start off. Dana, one, chapter 3, Halacha 1.
It is permissible to begin the performance of a forbidden labor on Friday, even though the labor is completed on its own accord on the Sabbath itself. For the prohibition against work applies only on the Sabbath itself. Moreover, when a task is carried out on its own accord on the Sabbath, we're permitted to derive benefit from what was completed on the Sabbath.
All right, so in the footnote 1, Shulchan Aruch emphasizes that this leniency applies even when one is certain that the forbidden labor will continue on its own accord on the Sabbath, as mentioned in the example cited by the Rambam in the following halacha. So, really important law here. According to general, you can begin a certain, I mean, there are actually a whole bunch of details in terms of qualifications. General rule is start something on Shabbat, even if it finishes on Shabbat, because the prohibition is to do the work on Shabbat, not so much that as he says here, Mutar lanu lehenot b'mashen aseh b'Shabbat ne'elav. You're allowed to benefit from work that was started before Shabbat. General rule. Continue with number 2.
What is employed? We may open an irrigation channel to a garden on Friday, causing it to continue to fill throughout the Sabbath day. We may place burning incense under garments, causing them to continue to be made fragrant throughout the entire Sabbath. We may apply salve to an eye or bandage to a wound, causing them to continue to heal throughout the Sabbath. We may mix ink with herbs before night and let the mixture soak throughout the entire Sabbath. We may place wool in a vat or strands of flax into an oven, so that their color continues to change throughout the entire Sabbath. We may lay out snares for wild beasts, birds, and fish at nightfall, so that they continue to be captured throughout the entire Sabbath. We may load the beams of an olive press or the round stones of a grape press at nightfall, so that the liquids will continue to flow throughout the entire Sabbath. Similarly, we may light a candle or a fire before evening so that it continues to burn throughout the entire set.
So let's just take two examples. There are a whole bunch here that get the same point across. One of the categories of prohibitions is you're not allowed to trap. But if you set your traps before Shabbat, then it's fine if they get trapped on Shabbat. We used to do that back when we lived in New Jersey. One of my jobs when we put up the sukkah was setting up bee traps. Anyone remember those bee trap thingies?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you're Israeli, so like you don't really have the same problems there. So there were these like little contraptions where you poured in some like honey, some sweet juicing, dilute with water, and the bees were supposed to be attracted to that instead of flying into your sukkah. Now, it would be prohibited to set that up on Shabbat or Yom Tov, but you could set it up beforehand, even if animals would get trapped on Shabbat or Yom Tov. By similar accounts, I think that last one is also like really hits the nail on the head. We light Shabbat candles, right? And the whole point of lighting Shabbat candles is that we benefit from fire on Shabbat. Right? That's as, I mean, you could just give that one example. I mean, I don't know why Rambam felt the need. I mean, I know where he gets these examples from, but like at some point it's overkill, but you get the point, right? You light Shabbat candles, you do something that's prohibited, something that would be prohibited if you did it on Shabbat, you do it before Shabbat, and it continues throughout Shabbat, and you're fine. Otherwise, you would never be allowed to light Shabbat candles, because the action that you started before Shabbat continues on Shabbat. Yeah.
How do we define benefit?
More detail coming up. The next few sections here deal with something that is incredibly, let's say, well, if not complicated, I don't want to say complicated, but it certainly can be confusing. And there are a whole bunch of laws attached to this. Some we still keep, keep a lot of this stuff today, but so many people keep without even realizing it. These are the laws particularly pertaining to setting up food before Shabbat to keep on cooking on Shabbat. And this can cause a great deal of confusion for many reasons. So if we have to go through this a little bit slower, we can, but this is a big topic, again, simply because it is ripe for confusion. Take number three on. It's, sort of a new thing about, the topic is doing stuff before Shabbat for it to continue on Shabbat. So now we're getting to the issue of food. Okay. All right, so all caught up.
A pot may be placed over a fire, or meat may be placed in an oven or over coals on Friday so that they continue to cook throughout the Sabbath with the intent that they be eaten on the Sabbath. With regard to this matter, however, there are certain restrictions that were enacted lest one stir the coals on the Sabbath.
Okay, so you are allowed to set up food before Shabbat to have it complete cooking on Shabbat. That's biblical. But Chazal, the sages, enacted certain rabbinic restrictions to ensure that you don't come to violate Shabbat. The classic example for this would be your typical cholent. And we're going to use that as the example, right? You think back to Europe, right? They had cholent before Europe. You're talking about putting up a pot of food before Shabbat. They didn't have blechs back in the day as we know it. So you would set up, we'll discuss blech in a bit. That was a bad choice of words. The point is, you put up a pot of food before Shabbat, and it would cook over Shabbat, and you'd have hot food for Shabbat day. Right? Now, if you lived in a place like Europe where you didn't really have electricity, this was the only way for you to have hot food in the middle of the winter. Technically, middle of the summer too, but it was more of a big deal in the middle of the winter. So there are restrictions, because when you have food, cooking all the way through, there's a concern you might mess with the whole concoction that would in fact be a violation for Shabbat. So we're going to see some examples of rabbinic restrictions and some ways that people have implemented it today in order to prevent you from actually breaking Shabbat, even though the simple act of letting food or starting a malacha before Shabbat continues on Shabbat is fine. There are certain things that we are concerned with that people are going to come to adjust, meaning, let's say, setting traps that he had in the second halacha. Once you set a trap, you're not going to mess with it. You set a trap and you leave it, right? You're usually not going to move it around. That kind of defeats the purpose of trapping. Even though you would not be allowed to move it, there was less of a concern for people messing with traps as there would be with food. Same thing with lighting, same thing with dealing with candles, although there were some exceptions in the Gemara. Usually when you have a candle, you just let it sit. You don't mess with it. And although there are reasons why you shouldn't spend, read specifically by the light of the candle. Because if you read by the light of the candle, you are more likely to, mess around with it so you got better reading light. All right? Okay, so far?
What is implied? When food has not been cooked to the extent that it is ready to serve, water has not been boiled, or food has been cooked to the extent that it is ready to serve, but the longer it cooks, the better it tastes, it may not be left over a fire on the Sabbath, even though it was placed there before the commencement of the Sabbath, lest one stir the coals to complete the cooking process or to cause it to cook more thoroughly. Accordingly, it is permissible to leave food cooking if one removed the coals one covered the coals in the range with ash or with thin chips from the combining of flax, the coals burn low, for then they are covered with ash, or the fuel used was straw, stubble, or the feces of a small animal, for then no coals will remain. In these instances, it is obvious that the person has diverted his intention from this food, Hence a decree was not enacted forbidding food to be left on the fire, lest he stir the coals.
So the first restriction, here we have the reason given for restriction and some details behind it. The concern is, if you have food that has not been completely cooked, I mean, again, there are more details, Rambam does one thing at a time. Food that has not been completely cooked, or it has been completely cooked, meaning it's fully edible, but it does better by cooking a little bit longer. Some people like their steaks well done, all right? When you have such an instance, you may have that temptation to adjust the flame, right? And because of that, there's a prohibition about having food cooked at this type of state before Shabbat, because you might come to adjust the flame, which would be a biblical prohibition. An exception would be if you take away that main heat source. And for this, you need to think back to the old ovens of the day. Let's say you have a coal-heated oven, or let's say you got yourself a barbecue, all right? And some you cooked it over the flames and whatnot. You know, I mean, technically, you don't cook over the flames of the barbecue. You cook over the like coals that get like red hot. So you remove the coals, and it's just being heated with residual ash. That would be okay, because once you've taken away the heat source, you've demonstrated that you're not going to mess with it, because there's nothing to mess with anymore. You no longer have a heat source. You're just dealing with the residual embers or whatnot that's there. Make sense? So far, we have a concern that you might come to, again, play with the coals, and that can go either in one of two ways. You can either, mush it around to make it hotter, or you can do things to cover it to make it cooler if you don't want things to get, like, super burnt. There are lots of ways that you can mess around with the fire in such ways that you would violate the biblical prohibition of Shabbat. So there's a rabbinic decree that when you set food up to finish cooking over Shabbat, it cannot be in this sort of state lest you come to mess around with the heat source. Make sense so far? Okay. Continue, number five.
When does the above apply? With regard to a range whose heat is minimal. With regard to an oven, in contrast, even if one removed the coals, covered them with ash, or used straw or stubble as fuel, we are not allowed to leave food in it or on it. Similarly, one should not put food close to it. This applies to food that was not cooked to completion or was completely cooked but will benefit from continued cooking. Since an oven is very hot, a person will not divert his attention from the fire. Hence, we suspect that he will stir the small fire that remains, even if it is straw or stubble, or even if it is covered.
All right, so here, there are two definitions of, let me rephrase that. There are two types of halachic ovens that are discussed in the Gemara. The first is a kira, which you can read in the footnotes like how he describes it, which is pretty much like your open barbecue grill thing. The tanur is more of, for a good way of describing this, would be more of a barbecue pit, where you've got a complete total enclosure of a heat source. And there's a greater risk of you going to adjust it. Can read again in the footnotes the details about how and why that would matter. But it could certainly apply to today. When you try to apply these, you know, older halachot to contemporary ovens, is something more like a tanur, right, completely enclosed, or something more like a kira? And you're going to have lots of debates about that, but at the very least recognize what the specific terms are here. Okay? Why did the sages forbid leaving food in the oven even if the fire was removed? Because a person can remove only the majority of the coals and their most intense heat. It is impossible to remove the entire fire so that not even a spark remains. Since an oven's heat is very warm, we suspect that he will stir the fire so the sparks that remain will in the oven will burn more. All right? So the concern, again, is with certain types of ovens, when you still can have that temptation to adjust the flame and adjust the heat source, that would be prohibited too. So that seems to be the main concern. All right? And we'll see in a bit how there are, even though that is the concern, there are ways of mitigating that we're going to see in greater detail that enable us to do the cooking that we do today. Data number seven.
A kapach is warmer than a range and not as warm as an oven. Therefore, if wood or geffet is used as fuel, it is considered equivalent to an oven, and we're not permitted to leave food within it, upon it, or next to it, if it was not completely cooked, or even if it was completely cooked but will benefit from continued cooking.
So even though you've got this other type of oven, which again, can read the footnote here, Rama explains that a kopach is built over the fire with a place for one pot, fires placed below it. The heat of a kopach is greater than that of a kira, because in a kira the fire is dispersed between two pots, and there is greater exposure to the air. So I guess you could think of this as your old like campfire. Right, something being heated over campfire, so it's not going to be as intense as a completely submerged, type of heated oven. At any rate, the point is you've got some middle ground. Rambam says the halacha for that is like a tanur, so we bump it up a notch.
The Hebrew says kupach.
Yeah. So continue. If straw or stubble.
Yeah. If straw or stubble was used as fuel, it is bound by the same rules as a range that was filled with straw or stubble, and food may be left cooking on it. What is a range and what is a kupach? A range is a place with an opening for two pots. A kupach is a place with an opening for a single pot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Risa, take this next halach. This is very important. This is Rambam 3:8.
When food has not been cooked at all or has been cooked to completion but will be impaired by further cooking, it is permitted to leave it cooking, whether on a range, a kopach, or an oven. Similarly, even when food has been cooked but has not been cooked to completion, or when it has been cooked to completion but will benefit from further cooking, it may be left on the fire if one placed an uncooked piece of meat in it shortly before nightfall, for the whole dish is considered to be entirely uncooked. This applies although one has not removed or covered the coals, for it has diverted his attention from this food and will not stir the coals.
Okay. So this might seem a bit counterproductive, or not kind of counterintuitive. We said at the very beginning, if you have food that hasn't been completely cooked, you're not allowed to, it's in the process of cooking, but hasn't completed cooking, or it will get better from subsequent cooking. You can't do that before Shabbat, lest you come to adjust the heat. But if the food that you put up is completely raw, or even as Rambam says, you throw in a little bit of raw meat in there, then it's fine. Why? Because raw food takes a long time to cook. Example, cholent, right? Now, the way that I put up a cholent, and this is great for procrastinators, you can put everything in your crock pot, and you just turn it on right before you leave shul on Shabbos. Now, a crock pot is also called a slow cooker. Even at the high temperature, that stuff isn't getting even close to hot for a really long time. No one's messing with it. Like, it's got to cook for a good 14, 15 hours, or however long it is. We're assuming the winter, right? So let's assume at least 14 hours before you get to it. You're not going to mess with it. According to Rambam, even if right before, let's say you set it up before Shabbat, right before Shabbat you throw in a piece of raw meat in there, well, you're not going to eat a cholent that has one piece of raw meat. And look, I went to yeshiva. Even in yeshiva, they're not going to do that. And they'll eat anything. Okay? So the point is, you know, there are ways, again, that you could get around the issue. Right? So it's weird that it either has to be completely fully cooked or not cooked at all. Because in either of those situations, you're not going to mess with adjusting the coals. And you remember, you either don't remove it or you don't cover it, right? Because you're not going to, it says, "Mipnei shekafar hisich da'ato mimenu." If anyone remembers the old infomercial, you set it and forget it. Remember that? I think it was one of Mr. Popel's things, of like the how to do a turkey in something the size of a toaster oven. Right, you set it, you forget it, because that's the glory of cholent. You're not supposed to, sir. You just throw it all in there. So you can set it up raw, like right before Shabbat, and you're fine. You can have it completely cooked before Shabbat, and that's okay. But let's say you set it up Friday morning, and you give it several hours to cook. It's in this quasi-liminal state where it's certainly going to get better through extended cooking, even if it's edible in its present state. Well, that right there might be a problem unless you throw in some raw meat. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm not sure this would be considered cooking, but I'm going to ask anyway.
Sure.
Automated coffee makers. Supposing you pour the water in before Shabbos, put the coffee grounds in, and it goes off on a timer.
I would have to see exactly how the thing is constructed. Because I've never actually... it's a little different there in terms of... Because there you're using the hot water to cook the coffee grounds. No.
Well, the water heats on a timer. If it's set to go off at 7 a.m. so that you can have coffee at 9...
Oh, the timer. We'll deal with timer things in a... that'll come up a bit later. Like the whole question about timers. Yeah, that's also... Yeah, somewhat complicated there. Again, there are modern technologies that make this even more complicated. Electric hot plates among them.
Yes.
Right? Because how does electricity fit into the whole cooking thing?
Right.
Which you might recall from our electricity shroom that we gave on Wednesday. And timers also. Yeah, I throw in random plugs to previous classes, not because I need the hits, but because when, you know, there are certain times that we'll dedicate an entire class to one topic. And it's easier to just give references to that than it is to, like, rehash an hour discussion. And that way you get the full, you know, range of thoughts. Or, like, there's a reason why I put in a lot of effort to give classes, because they're useful for re-referencing down the line. All right. So this with Halacha 8 is a very important law for those people who make cholent. You do it right before, again, this is great for procrastinators. The only risk is, and I've seen this happen, people who intend to flip the crock pot on before Shabbat and forget to do so.
Ooh.
That happens. Don't do it. But the other way of getting around it is simply, you can set it up at any time on Friday, unless you be concerned, throw in some raw meat right before Shabbos, and according to Rambam, at least, you are good to go for the rest of Shabbos, because that raw meat still needs a long time to cook in that slow cooker. Okay? And this is for people... Anyone here make cholent, incidentally? Yeah. Wow. Normally people... cholent's usually one of those go-to meals because it's just so simple. It's only good, really, if you invite a lot of people over, because cholent for one or two is kind of pathetic. Like, the last time I made a cholent was actually for the shul. There was a member who wanted to learn how to make cholent, and, you know, instead of, like, it was easier for me to just bring in my own crock pot, you know, and do it with him, and we went through a lot of these halachot in terms of, like, why did cholent become such a popular dish, and largely it's because of the halachic convenience. We also had the entire 6 quarts of it was completely gone at Kiddush, which I will either take as a compliment or, and it was the Galitzianer Shabbos that we had, and they really appreciate it. It was the few times I put in flanken. We'll talk about recipes at some other time, but at least you see halachot here, either fully cooked, such that additional cooking would make it bad, or completely raw, such that in neither case, you're discouraged and disincentivized from messing with the heat source, which is the rabbinic concern about having food starting to cook before Shabbat and continuing to cook on Shabbat. All right?
And what if you're doing a vegetarian cholent?
Same deal. Actually, that's an interesting question. If you're setting a vegetarian cholent, throwing in the raw vegetables wouldn't really matter so much. But there are other things that you could put in that would still require it to be cooked, like... One primary ingredient in cholent is barley, right? So if you put in barley, well, because you can put in soft beans too. Oh. Meaning if you use beans from a can, it's not going to matter. Those are edible straight out of the can. Barley. No one eats raw barley, right? So you can say, well, put in a whole bunch of barley, so let that cook, because until it's cooked, it's completely inedible. So that's something that you can be concerned with as well. Right? Or, if you're using beans, to use the dried beans that would be inedible in their current state and would need to be cooked. But barley would be a little bit safer, even though the way I make cholent, you put the barley in first because it, you know, is going to soak up all, yeah, details. But that's a way of getting around it. You put in something that would be inedible in its current state that needs to be, or that would be raw, that you would really want cooked all the way. And vegetables would be tricky because vegetables can be eaten raw, so I've been told. All right. Any arguments there? No? All right. Well, something that couldn't be eaten in its raw state. All right. Take number 9.
The following rules apply whenever a person left food on a fire in a situation where he was prohibited against doing so. If he transgressed and left the food cooking intentionally, he is prohibited to eat it until Saturday night and must wait until enough time passes for it to have cooked. If he forgot to remove it from the fire on Friday, greater leniency is allowed. If the food was not completely cooked before the commencement of the Sabbath, it is forbidden to eat it until Saturday night. If it was completely cooked, but further cooking will benefit it, it is permitted to be eaten immediately on the Sabbath.
All right. So this is, actually, there are a lot of laws that are embedded here that require some explanation. To what extent can you benefit from a violation of Shabbat? That is the overarching thing here that's not really stated explicitly. There's a three-way dispute in the Talmud. As Rambam makes the Psak Halacha, goes like this. If Someone intentionally broke Shabbat, did so b'mezid, you are not allowed to derive benefit from it at all. Meaning, at no point, it's a matter of a kenas. There's a certain fine attached to that. Okay? However, let's say someone did it b'shogeg, someone did it accidentally. You are not allowed to benefit from it on Shabbat. You have to wait the time period that we call kedei sheya'asu, the amount of time it would take to complete the action. That's the amount of time you have to wait until after Shabbat. Anyone want to take a guess why? Let's say the amount of time it took you to do this malacha was an hour. So you could only derive benefit from it an hour after Shabbat. Anyone want to guess why? You need that 1 hour window. No thoughts?
To give you the...
Yeah, two answers here, yeah. What'd you say?
To make up for the time you spent doing it.
Meaning, and what does that do for you? I mean, you're right, but explain why.
I don't...
Give you the opportunity to... Give you basically the same amount of time you would have taken to do it.
Yeah, that's what Kadesh Yasu means, but why?
So you have all of Shabbat?
Kind of.
So that you'll fulfill the 25-hour Shabbat.
No, it's not a matter of fulfilling the 25-hour Shabbat. The concern is, are you deriving benefit from accidentally breaking Shabbat? Now, if you wait the time of Kadesh Ya'asu, the answer is no. Why? Because if it took you an hour, let's say it takes an hour to do it, and you wait until an hour after Shabbat in order to use it, then you gained nothing by having this violation of Shabbat having taken place. If you do it within that hour, let's say you do it within a half hour after Shabbat, you partake of this cholent, okay? That means that you benefited from an accidental breaking of Shabbat by a half hour. Saved you a half hour in time. By waiting for the full amount, you are no longer deriving benefit from having broken Shabbat accidentally. Because the advantage you got of time is washed away. Make sense? Mm-hmm. That's the importance of Kadesh Ya'asu, that you are not taking advantage after Shabbat from something that was done on Shabbat. Even if you did it by accident, once you wait that time of Kadesh Ya'asu, any benefit you got is negated because you could have just as easily done it after Shabbat. All right? See, there's a certain logic to this. Okay? Next. Right.
Whenever food is permitted to be left on a fire, if it was taken from the fire on the Sabbath, it is forbidden to return it to its place. Food may be returned only to a range from which the coals have been removed or covered, or to a range or a kopak that was heated with straw or with stubble.
Okay, so this is a problem of chazara. Anyone hear of this term? When you remove something from a heat source, you cannot return it directly to the heat source, unless the coals have been removed or covered. Now, Rambam used that idiom before, and it's worth explaining in greater detail, of gerufa or mechuse. Anyone know what the importance of removed or covered means? It's worth explaining here. Both of them can serve either one of two purposes, and this comes up in halachic literature in terms of the significance of being covered versus and removed. What is the point? One approach is to say you are removing the heat source or causing some sort of interruption that would sort of get in the way of you adjusting it in the future. Meaning if you've got a heat source and you lower the heat, you're going to be less tempted to mess around with it because you know that it's not going to be at an optimal temperature. Another approach is it's there to serve as a reminder that, hey, you're doing something different, you shouldn't mess with it. This applies more to the removing is when you remove it from the heat source and you have that sort of interruption. The covering part can serve either purpose. Because if I'm cooking with coals and I cover it with ash, I go in to look and, you know, mess around with the coals. I say, wait a second, this stuff is covered with ash. It's normally not covered with ash. Oh, right, I'm not supposed to mess with it. Right? So those are two reasons why people... there are two reasons given as to what purpose the covering of the coals or removing the coals has. Practically speaking today, we might see this later, you may see in certain communities where You'll either have a type of a blech, which would be something covering the heat source, that giant metal tin, right, that people put over the fire that serves this purpose. Because you're setting up that interruption between directly between the heat source and the food above. You will find some people in crock pots will line that little thing, assuming you've got a crock pot with a removable insert. Some have it all together. Many have, you know, a ceramic insert that goes into this metal enclosure thingy, and it fits exactly. The metal enclosure, what gets heats up, it heats the ceramic, which heats the food, right? So some will line the ceramic with tin foil to accomplish the same goal. What you may also find people do, either independent or in conjunction to cover all bases, is to put tin foil over the knobs. Why? As a sign of a heker, as a sign of a reminder. So if you see a crock pot with a thing of tin foil over the knob, or if you see, in addition to a giant metal thing, fire, people put on tin foil over the knobs on the range, this is where they're getting it from. Okay? That is the source. If you go to someone's house and you see tinfoil all over the place, that is in a super, super nutshell why people do that. Whether or not they even understand the details where that comes from, because very rarely do people go through it inside, that's the detail and that's the basis in terms of the effect that covering and removing the coals have, applying that to our modern-day ovens. All right? Now, in terms of the chazara, you can. It says here you can only food may be returned only to a range with the coals have been removed or covered, or to a range where the chuppah that was heated with straw or stubble. When you're talking about, let's say you even had a cholent that was set up before Shabbat, done completely well. If you return it to a source, it could only be done to a source that has these. Let's call that tikkunim. Certain adjustments made to the heating elements such that you won't be tempted to mess around with it anymore. Because let's face it, you take something off of the stove, you want to put it back on, can still continue, right? Continue with the halacha. There's more on the next page.
This leniency is granted provided the food was not placed on the ground. If it was placed on the ground, it may not return even to a range whose coals were removed or covered. Similarly, food may not be returned to an oven or to a kopak that was heated with gefet or wood, despite the fact that one has removed or covered the coals, for they are very hot. When food should not be returned to a cooking surface, it should also not be placed next to it to warm.
Okay. So here we should go through some of the footnotes here that explain a little more practicality. 37, based on Shabbat 38b, Torah emphasizes that one must have removed the food from the range with the intent of returning it, otherwise it is considered placing the fire anew. The Shulchan Aruch quotes the Rambam, see, without mentioning this factor, so there's a bit of a dispute in terms of what does it mean to put it on the ground. All right, so there's a dispute amongst later authorities whether or not you, when you took it off the heat source, you had to have in mind to return it. Or, even if you didn't have in mind, as long as you didn't set it on the ground, you're still okay. So this would mean your typical serving tray. Right? There's sometimes, like if you got a big meal, it's easier to just walk around with the hot stuff and put it back. Footnote 38, many contemporary authorities allow one to return a pot to a covered range if one placed it on a table, provided one held the pot at all times. That seems to be a bit of a leniency here too. Meaning, as long as you were in constant contact with it, the fact that you put it on down on the table because it was big and heavy still is permissible to have it returned to a range. 39 is mentioned in note 14. Most contemporary authorities maintain that our household ovens are governed by the laws applying to ranges. Right? But again, you can understand like why there would be a dispute as to what extent do our ovens match these, you know, especially with here, you've got a few possibilities. You've got an oven that was left on all Shabbat. You've got a range, meaning the heat thing that was left on, assuming with a blech. And you've got electric hot plates, right? You've got all of these sorts of things that you're going to have lots of disputes over. Okay? Footnote 40, the Magen Avraham states that this refers to placing or returning the food near a source of heat on the Sabbath itself. One may, however, leave food near a source of heat on Friday so that it will remain warm on Shabbat. The Ramah allows one to place food near a source of heat on Shabbat as long as it's completely cooked previously. Here is where we get into a whole slew of details, and where you're going to find lots of disputes about what to do, some people being stricter, some people being more lenient. I'm not going to get into details of specific Piskei Halacha here, because no matter what someone says, someone's going to find some place to disagree. Not the point of what we're doing in this class, as much as trying to give you an overview of what some of the problems are. Problem that, or at least, let's not call it, we don't want to call rabbinic decrees problems, but a decree that you need to be aware of is this prohibition of chazara. That once you take it off the heat source, there is a prohibition about putting it back on the heat source. To what extent is this applicable to our ovens today? I will leave that as an open question. But know that that is a prohibition that you need to be aware of when it comes to having food cooked on Shabbat, of returning it to a heat source. Okay? All right, next.
It is forbidden to insert a ladle into a pot to remove food while it is on a fire on the Sabbath, because while doing so, one stirs it. Stirring is one of the activities necessary for cooking, and thus one will be cooking on the Sabbath. It is permissible to shift a pot from one range to another, even when the heat of the first range is not as great as the heat of the second range. One may not, however, take food that was on a range and cover it to maintain its heat, or take food that was covered to maintain its heat and place it on a range.
Okay, so here are a few distinctions about more details Rambam is giving you. One, you're not allowed to stir, because stirring helps the cooking process. So let's say you have a chillant pot, right, going. Now sometimes like, oh, we want to stir to make sure. Yeah, you can't do that on Shabbat itself. You can do it before Shabbat, but on Shabbat, no good. What this also means is, and I've told people here when we make cholent, when you serve cholent, you don't put the ladle in first. You first have to remove it, right? And we're assuming that you have one of these removable inserts, which if anyone is interested in crock pots, I highly recommend them because it makes it a lot easier to clean. I would also say, yeah, and I know this is somewhat of a digression, but if people aren't into it, you can get crock pots in two different shapes, circles or ovals. For cooking purposes, I've been told the ovals are better for getting you a better surface area, but the circles are a whole lot easier to clean because the big ovals are very unwieldy. That point aside, before when you actually serve the crock pot, right, less stuff, you take out the insert, you don't put the ladle in while it is still cooking. You pick it up, you put it down, then you put in the ladle. Otherwise, you are assisting in the cooking process. Okay? Now, let's say you've got a gas range, right, where you've got fire going off and you've got the blech on top of it. You've got one burner on high, one burner on medium. According to Rambam, you're allowed to move stuff around, but you're not allowed to really pachka with it. Or at least, although here he does say, you can shift from one way to another, even though it's not the range of the first is not as great as the range of, it's not as great as the heat of the second range, right? So it seems at least that you can, like, lower it. Raising it might be problematic because you're assisting with the cooking process, right? Because if you're going it from a lower heat to a higher heat, you're going to help stuff cook faster. You're not allowed to cover it or do other things to assist in the cooking process, including, let's say you set your cholent up and you came home from shul and you realized, hey, I forgot to cover the lid. Now, you know what happens when you don't cover a crock pot? No? The entire thing evaporates. Within hours, you're going to have burnt to a crisp stuff because all that liquid just goes straight out. All right? Still, you're not allowed to cover it. All right? So then you're stuck and just tell your guest you cooked Cajun that week. All right? Number 12.
See you, I think.
What?
You're number 12.
Oh, I'm 12? Oh, sorry. A person should not fill a pot with peas or beans or a jug of water and place them in an oven on Friday before nightfall and leave them to cook, even when the above and other food items are not cooked at all, because they are considered food that was not completely cooked, because they do not require a substantial amount of time to cook. So this would actually negate that whole barley thing, right? Well, the truth is, I honestly have no idea how long it takes to cook barley. But the assumption is, if it doesn't require a substantial amount of time to cook, not going to help. Therefore, the person will continue to pay attention to them, for he intends to partake of them immediately. Accordingly, it is forbidden to leave them in an oven unless they are completely cooked. If one transgressed them and left them in an oven, it is forbidden to partake of them until Saturday night. Even then, one must also wait the amount of time necessary to cook. All right, so this helps answer your question. Not, again, assuming you've got food that you want to throw in right before Shabbat and it's vegetarian, pick something that would take a long time to cook. Now, if that's barley, maybe, right? I don't know. How long does it take barley to cook?
Like rice, I think. Not that long.
I don't cook barley unless it's in cholent. I also don't cook rice that well.
Oh.
I know. Maybe also if you have a lot of stuff there, meaning if you're cooking a grain, like if you're talking about one grain of rice or one grain of barley, that's nothing. You put in a whole bunch of it, that's something else, because the water has to get all dispersed and whatnot. Yeah. Right? So then, like, yeah, you might have put in a lot of barley, but it's going to take a long time for all of that barley to get cooked. Again, this is not so much a halachic question as much as a culinary question. And this is something in which I recuse myself completely. The point is, if it's something that's easy to cook, you negate the whole advantage of putting it in before Shabbat when it's raw. Okay? Let's see now. I think let's stop here because we did a lot of stuff today and we'll pick up next week with number 13. Right, because there's no pun intended here. There's a lot to digest about the rules. But as a quick summary, one, in terms of setting food up before Shabbat, it either has to be completely, totally cooked or not cooked at all. The concern is you might come to mess with the cooking part over Shabbat, which can take in one of two ways. Either you mess around with the heat source, which you can mitigate somewhat by removing the coals or by covering the coals or adjusting somehow the heat source itself. And another way that you can mess with it is by messing with the food itself, be it by covering it, being by stirring it. All that stuff you can't do. The other thing that you need to be concerned with is returning food from its heat source to the heat source. And I'm using that term heat source in a very loose definition. Whether or not that applies specifically to our ovens or to electric hot plates, I will leave as an open question. We're going to assume for now fire, which is, you know, indisputable. There are problems of returning it to the heat source on Shabbat. Okay? Those should be the major takeaways for right now. Everyone okay with that?
Yes, sir.
All right. Have a wonderful weekend. For those interested, just a reminder, we've got a great event this Tuesday, a Chinese dinner and a movie. We'll be showing The Rabbi's Daughter, featuring the filmmaker, Acheli Wasserman. I thought it was a fantastic film. I saw it when it was released on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah.
So you guys should be off for then. And Wednesday night, we have our current Jewish questions. We'll deal with egalitarianism. So I know many people are going to be off that day, and that should also be a really fun class. So hope to see you all, if not this coming week, then next Sunday. Be well.